Sadashiv Samarambham Sadashiv Samha Shankaracharya Madhyamam Shankaracharya Asmaracharya Paryantam Asmaracharya Paryantam Vande Guru Paramparam Vande Guru Paramparam Shankaram Shankaracharyam Shankaram Shankaracharyam Keshavam Bararayanam Keshavam Bararayanam Sutra Bhashakratau Vande Sutra Bhashakratau Vande Bhagavantau Punaf Punaha Bhagavantau Punaf Together Om Sahana Vavatu Sahanau Bhunaktu Saha Viryan Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om. Very good. Nice to see you all, and welcome to our first Vedanta class for this season. As you know, each year we take off over the summer months, and we restart our Vedanta class in September. And this evening we begin our study of Viveka Chudamani. I'll introduce the text properly in just a moment. we should begin by recognizing that Viveka Chudamani is a text authored by Sri Shankaracharya. Shankara, as most of you know, is an 8th century teacher of Advaita Vedanta. And he is primarily known for his commentaries. In fact, he's so much known for his commentaries that he's often referred to as Bhashyakarta, the one who wrote the commentaries. Bhasha means commentary, so Bhashyakarta. In fact, in commentaries, when Shankaracharya is referred to, he's often referred to as Bhashyakarta, the author of the commentaries. And his commentaries are on the Bhagavad Gita, very important commentary, which I actually use every week in preparing for our Saturday morning Bhagavad Gita class. Perhaps his most important commentaries, though, are on the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras. The Upanishads are really the source material for all Vedantic teachings, the revelations of the ancient rishis about the true nature of reality are expressed for the very first time in those Upanishads. The Upanishads are fairly obscure, most of them, and hard to follow. So for that reason, Sri Shankaracharya wrote commentaries on 10 of the most important Upanishads. And those commentaries are extremely important in our study of Vedanta. He also wrote a very important commentary on the Brahma Sutras, a more technical text reconciling all the Vedantic teachings. So primarily, Shankaracharya, then, is known as the Bhashyakarta, as the author of the commentaries. Sri Shankara is not the founder of Advaita Vedanta, as many people wrongly assume, because the tradition of Advaita Vedanta was around for a long time before Shankara came. Truly speaking, the tradition of Advaita goes back to the Upanishads themselves. The ancient rishis expressed in these Upanishads the teachings of Advaita, the teachings of non-duality. Sri Shankara, however, is extremely important as the one who, maybe we could say, systematized those teachings of Advaita. He created a certain... I can't say he created a structure. He didn't create a structure. But in his commentaries, he gave such clarity and direction, a very single-pointed approach to those Upanishads, to those teachings of Advaita, and Sri Shankaracharya definitely is recognized for that. So in addition to his formulation of the teachings of Advaita, in addition to his authorship of these commentaries, He also authored a number of short texts. They're not all short. One of them, known as Upadesha Sahasri, 1,000 verses. The current text has almost 600. Viveka Chudamani has almost 600 verses. So they're not all short, but they're in English we would call them introductory or independent texts. That would be a better term. Independent texts. The Sanskrit term we use is Prakarana Granta. Prakarana, put some of this terminology up on the board. The terms that are probably less well known. Prakarana Granta is an introductory, not an introductory text. They're not all introductory. Independent, that's the word I'm looking for. An independent text. Independent means it's not connected with the Upanishad, it's not connected with the Bhagavad Gita or with the Brahma Sutra. So it forms an independent text. These Prakarana Granthas, we've studied several of them here. In fact, when we came here to this ashram 13 years ago, our very first text was Tattva Bodha, a very simple methodical text on Vedanta. We also studied Atma Bodha. A couple of years ago, in our Tuesday evening classes, we covered a series of 6 or 7 short texts of Sri Shankara, and that formed our subject matter. Starting this evening, we start our study then of Viveka Chudamani, which is one of these Prakarana Granthas. It's some 581 verses, and I should mention here that many scholars feel strongly that this text was not authored by Adi Shankara himself. Oftentimes he's referred to as Adi Shankara, the first Shankara, because Shankara then was passed along as a term of respect, as a title for his successors that occupied 4 ashrams that he founded in various parts of India. So the successors who occupied these 4 important seats in these 4 ashrams were also called Shankaracharyas, as most of you know. And that tradition exists to this day, where today there are 4 Shankaracharyas in India. To distinguish this one, we call him Adi Shankara, the first of the Shankaras. And the reason I'm making this explanation is that many scholars feel that Viveka Chudamani was not authored by Adi Shankara. Adi Shankara is the Bhashyakarta, the author of the commentaries. And when you compare the teachings of those commentaries to the teachings of Viveka Chudamani, you can indeed find some differences. Differences in style, and even a few differences in content or approach. The differences are small, not huge, but they're absolutely present. And that leads scholars to conclude that this Viveka Chudamani was not authored by this Adi Shankara. But in spite of, even if you accept it or reject it, that's up to you. I don't think it's of much consequence. What is consequential, however, is to recognize that the teachings of Viveka Chudamani are absolutely consistent with what Adi Shankaracharya taught. There is absolutely no inconsistencies. In fact, it very much follows his teaching methodology, his prakriyas. It would be reasonable to assume that Viveka Chudamani was written by one of his disciples, either one of his immediate disciples or several generations later. It's absolutely a text in Sri Shankara's tradition. So whether it's authored by Adi Shankara or not is a little bit, in my opinion, beside the point. We're here not to be engaged in a scholarly study anyway. Our purpose, as we'll see when we get to the very first verse, our purpose is to be engaged in a process of self-inquiry, and that will be our focus throughout. Now, I mentioned that Viveka Chudamani, the name, Viveka means discriminative understanding. Specifically, understanding what is real and understanding what is not real, that kind of discriminative understanding. So the Chudamani the money, the jewel, which is at the chuda, the top, the crest. The chuda money is crest jewel. And viveka, discriminative understanding. So often a text is translated crest jewel of discrimination, which sounds very impressive but means nothing. What does that mean, crest jewel of discrimination? It's just kind of a fancy name, a very evocative name for the contents of the text, which is actually very, very wonderful, simple text on Advaita Vedanta. When I say simple, I don't mean simplistic. Simple, I mean it avoids all the really technical stuff that you find in some commentaries and in the Brahma Sutras. So it's a very straightforward text. I think we're going to have a wonderful study. Now, it turns out, as I mentioned, that the text of Viveka Chudamani is 581 verses long, and that's much, much too long for us to take up in this Tuesday class. We begin now in September. We have to wrap up by next May, and in order to go through 581 verses, we would need a couple of years of weekly classes to go through. However, recognizing the length of the text, and also recognizing that some of the portions of the text are rather repetitive. There are some areas in the text which are repetitive. One of my guru's disciple, Pujya Swami Dayananda, has many, many disciples. One of his senior disciples is one Swami Paramarthananda. Some of you know him. He stays in Chennai and gives classes there, and he's a very well-respected teacher. He went through these 581 verses of Viveka Chudamani and very carefully selected from them 108 verses, which are extracted from the 581. And these 108 verses have been carefully chosen so that they unfold the teachings of Vedanta, excluding some detours that we find in the text and excluding some of the repetition that's found in the text. And by doing that, several things are accomplished. Perhaps for us, the most important thing that's accomplished is that we have the opportunity to go through these 108 verses in this class. The 108 we can manage, I hope. We'll see how it goes as time goes along. So hopefully by May we'll come to the last of these verses. There's another thing, another benefit, I think, of reducing the scope of the, reducing the length of the text. Sometimes if a text is very, very, very long, you can get lost in the text. Nowadays, I'm reading a text for my own pleasure called Laghu Yoga Vasishta. Laghu Yoga Vasishta is the short form of Laghu Vasishta. Laghu Vasishta is 24,000 verses. You can get lost in that. Laghu Yoga Vasishta is a short version. It's only 6,000. Bhagavad Gita is 700 verses to show the contrast. So in such a large text, it's pretty easy to get lost. And actually, for that reason, I actually have to make notes as I'm going through. Otherwise, I forget what I've already read as I go on and read the later passages. It's just so immense. So even 581 verses are large enough to get lost in. 108 verses is a really, really good length. So we can enter into that, and without getting lost, without getting overwhelmed, we can remember what came before, we can have a sense of direction. So I think it makes for an excellent, excellent study. Many years ago, at Arshavidya Gurukulam, where I used to live and teach, we were teaching the full 581 verses as part of the Sunday program there. That went on for year after year after year after year. Pujya Swamiji himself admitted it was a mistake to have chosen that text for the Sunday morning classes. It just didn't work out very well. So now, with Swami Paramarthananda's efforts, we have this 108 verses that we'll be using for our study. All right, some study notes which will help you. Let me put the first verse up. And So here is the first of the verses. You'll find that each verse at the end has a number. That number is the number of the original 581 verses. So if you want to refer back to the original 581, you'll see here. Notice we go from verse 1, 2, 4, 6, 11. So you can see what's happening here. So that'll help you refer to the original text. You notice that there's no translation as a part of these slides for several reasons. One is the translation just won't fit on some of the slides. Second reason is this is not an introductory class. This is a class where you're expected to be, you know, fairly dedicated students. Your responsibility is to get a translation and use it. Now, using the translation means, and I mean this very seriously, read the translation of wherever we are in a text. You should read a few verses before and after wherever we are in a text. You should read that before coming here. I feel very strongly that you should have the context in your mind before the class begins. In order to do that, if you're taking notes, you can review your notes. But in addition to that, I think it's very important that you read the section that we're studying, you read the translation. Now, to make things a little easier for you, we have some resources on our website. First of all, these slides are available on our website. Some of our students have a habit of printing out the slides and taking their notes on those slides. That's a very good thing to do. If you're interested, these slides are available on our website. Also available on our website is a translation, a translation by Swami Madhavananda, who is a monk of the Ramakrishna order. And it's a reasonable translation. No translation is great. Many translations are horrible. This one is an adequate translation. So that translation is available on our website. You can just go there and print it out. You may also want to purchase that. And if you're going to purchase a book, I would recommend purchasing that Swami Madhavananda's translation. It's available, I think it's available on Amazon.com for about $5. Can you manage that? I think you can manage that. The publisher, by the way, is Advaita Ashrama. Advaita Ashrama is a publishing wing of the Ramakrishna Mission. So it's a translation. Let me put that up on the board. So that is a translation by Swami Madhavananda, published by Advaita Ashrama. So you can get a copy of the book, or if you prefer, you can just go to our website. You can just print out the pages. The book includes the Devanagari and his commentary. The what's on our website is only translation. Also on our website, when I was roaming around on the web, I came across an e-book. An e-book means an electronic book. It has the text in both Devanagari and Roman letters. It has the translation, and it has a word by word for word translation, which many of you will find helpful, and a commentary. And all of this has been prepared by one Brahmachari Pranipata Chaitanya. I believe he's a disciple of in Swami Chinmayananda's lineage. I think he studied at Sandipani Sadhanalaya in Mumbai. And I didn't go through it in any detail at all. I looked over it. It looks reasonable. And you may find it helpful if you want to read a commentary. That would be a good commentary to read. Madhavananda's commentary may not be as consistent with our studies here. So Swami Madhavananda, like many of the monks in the Ramakrishna tradition, are not so solidly in Sri Shankaracharya's Sampradaya. So I'll warn you in advance that Madhavananda's commentary may or may not agree completely with what we discuss here. This Pranipata Chaitanya's commentary that you find in that e-book which is available on our website, will probably be more consistent with our discussion here. So if you want that, it's again freely available on our website. Also, these classes will be posted to the website. The audio of these classes will be posted to the website. So if you miss a class, you can listen to the audio before attending the next class. Continuity is going to be pretty important in this kind of study. So if you do miss a class, then if you have the time, definitely go to the website, listen to the audio of the class, so that when you come the next time that you're on track with all of us. Okay. I think that is enough. So with that introduction, we begin at the beginning with the first of our 108 verses. Repeat after me. Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta, Sarva Vedanta Gocharam Tamagocharam, Gocharam Tamago, Govindam Paramanandam, Govindam Param Sadgurum Pranatosmyaham, Sadgurum. It's a tradition to begin a text with a prayer, and in this text there's no exception. We begin with a prayer. Sri Shankaracharya begins with a prayer. And the prayer is addressed to his guru, but the prayer definitely has a double meaning. It's a very common thing to do in Sanskrit, especially at the beginning of a text in a prayer. You can have a double meaning. Look at the second half. Govindam Paramanandam Sadgurum Pranataha Asmi Aham. Aham, I, Asmi. We have to break the words apart here. Aham, I, Asmi, I am Pranataha. Pranataha literally means bent over. I'm bowed. Bowed at whose feet? I am bowing in prayer. I am prayerfully bowing to whom? Sadgurum. To the true guru. Sri Shankara is addressing this prayer to his guru, who he calls Sadguru. Sadgurum Pranataha Asmi Aham. I bow to the feet of my guru. My guru who is Govindam. Govinda was the name of his guru. His Parama Guru was Gaudapada, very important teacher in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, the author of a commentary on the Mandukya Upanishad, known as a Karika, and Gaudapada's Karika is one of the very, very important, more advanced texts in Advaita Vedanta. So Gaudapada was Sri Shankaracharya's guru's guru. Sri Shankara's guru was Govinda. So Govindam Sadgurum Pranata Asmi Aham. I bow to the feet of my guru, Govindam. Govinda, who is called here Paramanandam, who is Parama Ananda, an embodiment, an absolute embodiment of Ananda. Now, you could take that as just praise of his guru, which it is. So he is praising his guru by calling his guru Paramanandam. But it also introduces the second meaning of the prayer verse, a double meaning. So who is he praying to? He's praying to Govindam. Govinda is not only the name of his teacher. Govinda is on our altar. It's a name for Bhagavan, name for God, name for Sri Krishna. And by extension, it's a name that can represent the highest goal of life. Look at how the verse begins. Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta Gocharam Tam Agocharam. Tam Agocharam. He's talking about his Sadguru. Sadgurum Govindam, my guru. Sad means true. So Sadguru, my true guru, who is Govindam, whose name is Govinda. Tam, him, he who is Agocharam. Agochara means not accessible, not available, literally not available for perception. Gocharam means that which you can see. That which you can see, hear, taste, touch, or smell is gocharam. And he says here that his guru is a gocharam. An invisible guru. Gosh. Do you really think that's what Sri Shankaracharya means? Certainly not. But he's using these words very deliberately because he's referring to another Govinda, not his guru, but another Govinda who is Paramanandam, who is absolute fullness and completeness, perfection, and Tam, that one which is Agocharam. Agocharam could mean Ishvara, the God of the cosmos, because Ishvara is not an entity that you can see walking down the road one afternoon. In that sense, Ishvara is Agocharam. Agochara is also a term we would certainly use for Brahman, the absolute reality. And it looks like Sri Shankaracharya, being the great Advaitin that he is leaning in that direction. And the reason I say that is when we see the whole verse together. Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta Gocharam Tamagocharam. So his teacher, Govinda, set that one aside. Now take this other Govinda, who happens to be Paramanandam, who happens to be a gocharam, not available for perception. If that one is not available for perception, how will we ever know that one? Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta Gocharam. The one who is gocharam, available for understanding through the Siddhanta. Siddhanta means the culmination of the teachings, what the teachings are meant to convey. And what teachings are we talking about? Vedanta. Sarva Vedanta. All of the teachings of Vedanta. Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta, the intended meaning of all of the teachings of Vedanta, make tam agocharam, make the one who is inaccessible gocharam, accessible. The inaccessible agocharam is made gocharam, accessible. How? Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta, through the teachings of Vedanta. So here in this verse, Sri Shankara very cleverly offers a prayer to his guru, Govinda, and also, I won't say hints. This is not a hint. This is, if you know Sanskrit well, this is not a hint. This one is fairly obvious. Obviously pointing to this double meaning where he's worshipping not only his guru, Govinda, but he's worshipping tam agocharam, that which is inaccessible to the senses, that which is paramanandam, absolutely full, complete, and perfect, and that which is sarva vedanta siddhanta gocharam, that which can be discovered with the help of the teachings of Vedanta. A very beautiful verse. Now, there's a tradition, which several traditions, when you begin a text. One, of course, is we begin with a prayer, as Sri Shankara has in the Viveka Chudamani. There's another tradition, very important tradition, in beginning a text that there is a convention that you must demonstrate the validity of your text before beginning the text. Or at the beginning of the text, the author must establish its validity. And perhaps the reason for this particular tradition was, remember in these days, this is an 8th century text, so in those days, how were these texts passed down from generation to generation? Laboriously writing them out on palm leaves. Now, to write out this 581 verse text on palm leaves is going to take someone maybe a month, every day, writing on his palm leaves. Maybe you take a month to write that out. So if you want a copy, you have to... If you want a copy, no one's going to make it for you. You have to borrow someone's copy. You have to write it out. Now, wouldn't it be terrible if you wrote out a text, you spent a month, and then you took it home to study, and you discovered that it was absolute junk. Useless. Didn't make any sense, wasn't something you're interested in studying, wasn't well written, wasn't well composed, it was just filled with utter nonsense. But you already invested a month in writing this thing out. So there's a convention wherein the author of a text must establish its validity at the very beginning of the text so that you can read that first verse or two and find out, is this really the text I want to read or copy out or not? So the validity is established. The validity is established through four principles, which are known as... And I want to do this fairly briefly. This is a little bit of a little scholarly thing, but since we're introducing the text, we'll include it. But it's really not going to be the focus of our study. But since it is relatively important, we'll do it briefly. This Anubandha Chatushtaya. Anubandha Chatushtaya is a set of four... Anubandha, requirements. Chatushtaya, a set of four anubandhas, four requirements. The requirements are to establish four things. First, what is the... I'm going to stay with the proper transliteration here. What is the subject matter? What is the prayojana? What is the goal? What is the sambandha? What is the connection? I'll explain these terms briefly in just a moment. And finally, who is the adhikari? Who is qualified to study the text? So these are the Anubandha Chatushtaya, Vishaya, Prayojana, Sambandha, and Adhikari. I'm going to stay to all Roman letters because if I write in Devanagari, some of you won't be able to read it. So these are the four criteria that establish the validity or the relevance of a text. Vishaya, what is the subject matter? So we should find that in this first verse. What is the subject matter? Govindam. Tamagocharam. Not this Govinda. The Govinda who is agochara, inaccessible for understanding in any other way. That one is the Vishaya. In a word, Brahman. Brahman is the Vishaya. Then, what is the Prayojana? So, if we say the subject matter is Brahman, that sounds very philosophical. The subject matter is to discover the absolute reality because of which everything exists. That sounds very philosophical, but something that I always discuss at the beginning of every text, and that is Vedanta is not philosophy. Period. Vedanta is not philosophy. Why? Philosophy is the pursuit of knowledge. That's what philosophy is all about, the pursuit of knowledge. Vedanta, and in the opening verses we're going to see the importance of knowledge, but the ultimate goal is not to collect knowledge. Like, people like to collect things. Do any of you collect things? Some people will. Sometimes I go to somebody's home and they have this display case with the glass doors, and you can see whatever they collect, it's all there. What do you collect? So you might collect something. Well, some people will collect knowledge. They like to learn. They like to collect knowledge. And if you're coming here, I'm sorry to be a little, I don't want to be harsh, but this is an important point. If you're coming here to collect some more knowledge, you're wasting your time. Because these Vedantic teachings are not meant to be collected and put on your display case, nor are Vedantic books meant to be collected and put on a bookshelf. The knowledge is the means to the end. Knowledge of Brahman is the Vishaya. Absolutely. The subject matter of this text is Brahman, and this text contains Brahma-jnana, knowledge about that Brahman. But that's not the goal. The goal is not to collect knowledge. The goal is moksha. Moksha is a word we use. Moksha literally means freedom. And in a Vedanta context, it specifically means freedom from suffering, freedom from limitation, freedom from all human worldly limitations. Specifically, though, freedom from suffering. Philosophy is not about freedom from suffering. Philosophy is about collecting knowledge. Philosophy is very much like science. In fact, many people would consider philosophy to be a kind of a science. Science is about the acquisition of knowledge, understanding what is, and no doubt science is an extremely important pursuit. Understanding the world around us is extremely important, but Vedanta is not interested in understanding the world around us. Vedanta has as its prayojana, as its purpose, as its intent, as its goal. The purpose of Vedanta is to solve the problem of human suffering. And for that reason, in my opinion, it's absolutely inappropriate to refer to Vedanta as a philosophy. Because philosophy in general is not interested in solving the problem of human suffering. Philosophy, in a most general sense, is acquisition of knowledge. Okay, enough said. So, the prayojana then, moksha, freedom from suffering. What is the sambandha? Sambandha, the connection. And this, in technical texts, it can go on for pages and pages on sambandha because there are so many different connections to be discovered. We'll just take the most obvious of the many connections, and that is, what is the connection between the vishaya and the prayojana? What is the connection between the subject matter and the... Oh, wait a minute, I forgot to make a connection for you. Prayojana, here in this verse... So which word expresses a prayojana in this verse? If vishaya is expressed by tamagocharam, that Brahman which is not accessible to our senses, then prayojana, the goal, which is moksha, would be expressed by which term here? I would choose paramanandam, absolute fullness, completeness, perfection. So the subject matter is agocharam brahma. The prayojana is paramanandam, fullness, completion, which is moksha. What is the connection between agocharam brahma and paramananda? How do you get from here to there? How do you get from that which is agochara, which is inaccessible, how do you get from there to discovering paramananda within yourself? Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta Gocharam. That's what these teachings are about. These teachings lead you to understand, lead you to gain knowledge of Brahman, the Vishaya, so that you can discover Paramanandam. That's the Sambandha. And the final one is Adhikari. Adhikari means the one who is qualified for study of this particular subject matter. This subject matter of Vedanta is not meant for anyone and everyone. So who is it that has the necessary qualifications, the correct attitude, the correct prerequisites. And we're going to talk about all this in great detail. The who is Adhikari is going to be discussed in the next verse or two a little bit, and then it forms the first major topic of the text, starting a few verses later. So Adhikari is going to be explored in great detail right in the beginning of this text. So this is the Anubandha Chatushtaya, establishing the importance and relevance of this text. So having Sri Shankara in his first verse, having saluted his guru, Govinda, having simultaneously praised that agochara brahman, that absolute reality, which is our prayojana, which is our vishaya, which is our subject matter, and having also kind of hinted at the Anubandha Chatushtaya, he completes all of this in the first verse, and with that, we proceed.
Durlabham trayam hevaitat, durlabham trayam heva. Devanugraha hetukam, devanugraha. Manushyatvam mumukshutvam, manushyatvam mumukshutvam. Mahapurusha samshrayaha, mahapurusha samshrayaha.
Durlabham trayam eva etat, etat, this. This is durlabham, this is difficult to gain. Etat trayam durlabham. This group of three is difficult to get, durlabham. It's so difficult, and we'll come back to this first line at the end. It's so difficult that it is only deva anugraha hetukam. It is only, hetuka means caused by. It is only caused by the anugraha, the grace of deva, of God. It is only gained with God's grace. These three, etat trayam, are so durlabham, so difficult to get, that no matter how hard you try, you can't get it. Only with God's grace. There are certain things in life that we can't accomplish with effort. You know that very well. Suppose, this is just absolutely silly. I don't know why this came to my mind. Suppose my goal was to become 6 feet tall. Right? Now, suppose my goal is to become 6 feet tall. How much effort would that take? It's not going to come by effort. It might have come by deva anugraha hetukam. It might have come by God's grace before I was born. It obviously hasn't. That's okay. But the point I'm making is that so many things of value in life that we take for granted are absolutely inaccessible through our own effort. They're gifts, gifts of God. What are these three gifts of God that Sri Shankaracharya says are these three? The first of them is manushyatvam. Manushya, human being. Manushyatvam, being born as a human being. And we take that for granted. Of course we're all human beings. Well, according to the doctrine of reincarnation, there's no rule that says we should have been born as a human being. We could have been born in any form. We could have been born as a cockroach or a worm. Who's to say? We don't know, according to the doctrine of reincarnation. According to the Bhagavad Purana and other texts, we find that there is a description of 84 lakh yonis, which is a term that are used. 8.4 million possibilities for your birth. So out of those 8.4 million, we got the jackpot. We did. So that's why Sri Shankara says that manushyatvam, birth as a human being, is durlabham. It is a rare gift, deva anugraha hetukam, that's acquired with God's grace. No matter how much punya karma you have, you might say, oh, Swamiji, it's a matter of making enough effort in your prior life. Let's examine, just very briefly, a little bit about the doctrine of reincarnation. No matter how pious you were in your last 100 lives, there's no guarantee that you're going to get a human birth in this life. That's the way the doctrine of karma works. You have sanchita karma, which is a collection of an infinite number of prior lives, and in those infinite number of prior lives, you had plenty of opportunity to commit many, many papa karmas, many, many sins. All of those papa karmas are part of your sanchita, so even if you were the most pious person to walk this planet for the last 100 births, there is still no guarantee that this birth would be a human birth. Therefore, deva anugraha hetukam. Birth as a human being is a gift of God. Not only being born as a human being, but mumukshutvam is also durlabham. Another rare gift is the status of being a mumukshu. Moktum iccha, mumuksha. Mumuksha means a desire for freedom, moksha. One who desires freedom is a mumukshu. One who desires moksha is a mumukshu. A mumukshu is one who desires freedom, desires moksha. Mumukshutva is a state of being a mumukshu. So the state of being a mumukshu is also considered a gift of God. Now, the fact that you're sitting here today indicates that you're a mumukshu. If you're not a mumukshu, you wouldn't be here. Well, not always true. Sometimes you get dragged along. That happens. Sometimes. Okay, assuming that you weren't dragged along, assuming you came here of your own free will and not your spouse's free will, then that indicates that you are a mumukshu. You have a desire for freedom. It's significant that to recognize, and I don't know if you reflect, I reflect on things like this all the time, how few people actually have a desire for spiritual growth. Now we look around in this room and there's so many of you, it's wonderful to see so many of you here. For a Vedanta class and for a big Vedanta class like this, I think it's just a wonderful thing. But it's a rare thing. You know, so if there are 100 of you sitting here tonight, how many are sitting in front of a television set? How many are sitting at a bar? That's another spiritual pursuit. Spirits. Very different. Something you know very well, you have a value for spiritual growth. Among your friends and relatives and acquaintances, how many of them share your values? Relatively few, isn't it? That's just a fact. So relatively few. So therefore, since so few of us have a value for spiritual growth, Sri Shankaracharya points to that one, mumukshutvam, as saying, this is durlabham. This one is rare. This one is deva anugraha hetukam. This one is a gift of God. By the way, mumukshutvam happens to be a main aspect of this adhikari. We'll come to that much more. But one aspect of being an adhikari, being a qualified student, one aspect of it is being a mumukshu. So, being born as a human being is rare. Having mumukshutva, having a desire for spiritual growth, a desire for moksha, is rare. And the final of these three, etatrayam, a group of three, the last of the three is maha purusha samshrayaha. Samshrayaha means taking refuge, finding refuge in a maha purusha, in a great soul, in a great person. Mahapurusha is a big word for a teacher. Mahapurusha samshrayaha, taking refuge or taking the assistance and support of a qualified teacher, Mahapurusha. Now, here again, these days we take it for granted. The teachings of Vedanta are so widely available today like they have never been in the history of mankind. First of all, you can go on the internet and find vast amounts of information about Vedanta, but a word of warning and something you already know. Probably two-thirds of what's out there is trash. Sorry to say. I mean, just really off. But that's two-thirds of a vast, vast amount of knowledge out there. That means one-third of what you're going to... This is just my interpretation. You can make up your own numbers. I make mine up all the time. So I'm saying that the majority of what's out there on the internet is probably not helpful. A minority is helpful, but that's a minority of a vast amount of information. It's a lot. So that's one way in which Vedanta is accessible. In ancient times, not only was there no internet, but if you wanted to study Vedanta, you would probably have to leave your home and go travel to some ashram miles or hundreds of miles away for the sake of studying Vedanta. Something we take for granted, I've pointed out before, that up until 100 years ago, Vedanta was not taught in public venues like this. Not in India and certainly not outside of India. So even to have access to Vedantic teachings outside of these ashrams, or which were up in the Himalayas or along the banks of sacred rivers, even that is a fairly modern invention. And today we have Vedantic teachings in your backyard, in Somerset, New Jersey, of all places. So this is the accessibility that we enjoy today. This is Mahapurusha Samsharaya. This is access to a proper teacher, access to proper teachings. According to Sri Shankara, it is durlabham. In modern times, I'm not so sure. In his time, absolutely durlabham. In modern times, maybe somewhat durlabham. But definitely manushyatvam, birth as a human being, is durlabham, rare. Mumukshutvam is also exceedingly rare. By the way, just a little bit of mathematics. I'd like to bore you with mathematics. Remember how math works? So rare means a small fraction. Suppose 1 out of 1,000 people get born as a human being. And then, mumukshutvam. Suppose 1 out of 1,000 are mumukshus. 1 out of 1,000 are human beings. 1 out of 1,000 are mumukshus. And then 1 out of 1,000 get contact with a proper teacher. What are the chances? That's 1 in 1 billion. Huh? I'm not saying these numbers are right. If these numbers are right, it suggests that 7 people on this planet. I don't think it's quite, the odds are a little better than that. But you get the point of how these odds work out. If human birth is rare, then having human birth and desire for spiritual growth is yet more rare than having human birth and having a desire for spiritual growth and having access to proper teachings is exceedingly rare. That's the point that Sri Shankara wants to make in this verse. He says that it is so durlabham that your effort is not sufficient. It is deva anugraha hetukam. It is gained with God's grace. It is a gift of God. This theme continues in the next verse.
Labdva katan katanjan,
that much.
Labdva katanjan narajanma durlabham, narajanma durlabham, tatrapi pumsatvam, tatrapi pumsatvam, shutipara darshanam, shutipara yastvatma muktyaina. Yas tvatma muktyaina yateta mudhadhihi, yateta mudhadhihi, sahyat mahaswam, vinihantya sadgrahat, vinihanya sadgrahat.
So this verse begins by quoting part of the prior verse. By the way, that prior verse, even though it's labeled 2, in the actual text, it's actually verse 3. You might want to correct it. It's incorrect on the slides. It's actually verse 3. Now we come to verse 4. Labdva katanchat narajanma durlabham. Labdva, having gained what? Narajanma, having gained birth as a human being, which is the first of the three things mentioned in the prior verse, having gained birth as a human being, katanchit, somehow means definitely not with your effort, definitely with God's grace. So having somehow gained human birth, narajanma, which is durlabham, as we discussed in the prior verse, which is hard to get, which is rare, tatra api, and also pumsatvam, having gained, here we got a little discussion. Pumstvam means not just narajanma means birth as a human being. Pumstva means birth as a male human being. We have a problem for about half of us. Now, when I come across things like this, so what Sri Shankara is saying is that, all right, you won the lottery, you got born as a human being, you have desire for moksha, spiritual growth, you have access to a spiritual teacher, but you're not born as a man? Now, almost every book you'll find printed in the last century or two will make excuses for this. Oh, he really means having male qualities, being assertive, being this, being that, being... I think they're missing the point. Shankara, when he wrote this 1,200 years ago, women had very little freedom in that culture, in that society, in that time and place. They had almost no scope for going off on a spiritual journey. The women were busy with the children, the women were busy with the crops, raising food. The women were busy at home, and by and large, the women simply didn't have the opportunities a male person would have for the pursuit of spiritual growth. It's a fact of the culture. So when at the time and place where Shankara was writing this, he's just saying it as it is for him, in his time and place. In modern times, thank goodness that women have the freedom that they deserve, the freedom that men have, and today it's no longer an issue. But in Sri Shankara's time, that's just the nature of society. What I find really amusing, though, is whoever is writing a modern book, a commentary on Viveka Chudamani, they'll always make excuses. Oh, Shankara doesn't really mean to exclude women. He does mean to exclude women, but not that he's not discriminating against women. He's making a factual observation about his culture at that time. If you were born as a woman 1,200 years ago, you simply would not have had the freedom to live a life of spiritual growth. That's just the way it worked. So I don't think there's any reason to make excuses here. Shankara said, born as a man. He meant. being born as a man, in spite of all the modern commentaries who will try to make excuses for Shankara. Shankara is not being a male chauvinist here. He's not putting down women. He's not saying women are inadequate to this study. He is saying women have no opportunity for this study because of the culture at that time and place. Okay, so we live in a different time and in a different place. So today it's no longer an issue. So let's just see that for what it is. So, Narajanma, being born as a human being, is durlabham, is rare. Pumstvam is also a great advantage in Shankara's time. But also, Shruti para darshanam. Darshanam, seeing, understanding. Shruti para, the entire scriptures. The entire Shruti, the entire scriptures, in particular the Upanishadic teachings, the teachings of Vedanta, the teachings of the Upanishads. So here what Sri Shankara is saying is, suppose someone, labdhva, having gained a human birth, and having gained a male birth at Shankara's time, and suppose that person is also Shruti para darshanam. This person has had the ability to study the scriptures. Now, study the scriptures here in a scholarly way. Suppose that person has had the opportunity for scholarly study of the Upanishads and other scriptures. But suppose yaha tu, breaking about the words, tu, but suppose yaha, that one, atma muktyai na yateta. Suppose that person who has born as a male human being, having access to the scriptures, but suppose that person na yateta. Suppose that person does not strive, na yateta, does not strive, atma muktyai, does not strive for atma mukti, does not strive for one's own moksha. Being born as a human being, being born male, having access to the scriptures, Shankara says, suppose that person does not seek moksha. Could happen, right? What about all those people sitting in front of TV tonight, right? Born as human beings, they have access to the scriptures. If they want to pursue it, they have access. But nayateta, they don't strive, atma muktyai, for spiritual growth, for moksha. Then what? Sri Shankara has some harsh words for them. He says, they are mudhadhihi. Their dhihi, buddhi, their minds are mudha, stupefied. They're dumb. They're dull-witted. They're thick as a brick, as our British friends would say. Mudhadihi. They are deluded. If he were to use an American idiom, he would say, they're idiots. If you spoke American English. And it's a harsh word, and he means to be harsh here. This is not he doesn't use that word mudhadihi accidentally. It's a harsh word chosen intentionally. Look what he goes on to say. Saha, such a person, such a mudhadihi, such a thick-headed person, saha, that person, he, indeed, we have to break the words apart, he, atmaha, he, indeed, that person is atmaha. This ha, affix, hun, hunti, one who kills. One who kills what? Atma, oneself. Such a person, Sri Shankara says, is atmaha. One who commits suicide is atmaha. Such dull-witted people, for all intents and purposes, commit suicide. Why would he use such strong language? That's how, you know, he's not merely saying that they're thick-headed. He's saying they're as bad as someone who commits suicide. How could that possibly be? He says, Swam Vinihanti. Vini, just to he reiterates to make it very clear. Vinihanti, such a person kills swam, oneself. Swam Vinihanti. Why would one kill oneself? Asat grahat. Due to graha, grasping asat, that which is unreal. Asat grahat. Due to grasping that is what is unreal, one, for all intents and purposes, commits suicide. Now, that needs to be explained. Graha. What do we grasp after in life? What do we go for? What do we seek out? In general, we seek out whatever makes us happy, whatever makes us content, whatever pleases us, whatever fulfills our desires, whatever we like. And in the same way, we let go or throw away anything that we dislike, anything that causes us pain or misery. So we spend our whole lives grasping. Can I just put it in more general terms? We spend our whole lives grasping for happiness. That's, I think, a fair statement. We spend our whole lives grasping for happiness. How successful are we? Somewhat. Would you agree? We grasp at happiness and we are somewhat successful, which means we have moments of happiness, but we also have moments of absolute misery. Sometimes we get what we want, sometimes we don't. Sometimes grasping is not very effective. If you grasp at a handful of sand, what happens? The sand runs through your fingers. You grasp at it, and you don't get what you want. We spend our lives grasping at happiness. We pick up moments of happiness, no doubt, but isn't it a little bit like the sand? It kind of runs away from us. And to make matters worse, and we discussed this in our satsang the other day, we not only want happiness, but, well, that word came in the very first verse, paramanandam. We don't just want happiness, we want uninterrupted contentment, peace, joy, and love in our lives. We want to be happy 100% of the time. We want to be content and at peace 100% of the time. Anything less doesn't seem to make us okay. We want something which is paramananda, is ultimately what we want, this state of perfect peace and contentment. This is such an important point. Let me make it clear. In fact, I'll use the metaphor I gave in the satsang recently. It's a story I made up. And the story goes like this. Suppose I had a pill. And I said, this is a very special pill. By the way, I understand that pharmaceuticals are very big in central New Jersey. So in one of these big pharma companies, they must be making this pill. A pill that if you take it, you would be happy 99% of the time. All you have to do is take this pill, and you'll be happy 99% of the time. And Swami Tadatmananda is ready to dispense this pill to you. How's that? Would you take that pill? Well, 99% of the time, compare that to your life. Are you happy 99% of the time? Doubtful. So whatever percentage of the time you're happy, 99% is probably significantly more. So if you could take that pill that would make you happy 99% of the time, and Swami Tadatmananda is offering you that pill, you'll all line up. I'm guaranteed. And you'll all take that pill, and you'll all be happy 99% of the time. Suppose, having taken that pill, you came here to class tonight, and tonight happens to be part of the 1% where you're absolutely miserable. And you will complain, Swamiji, the pill you gave is useless. I am so miserable. I am so unhappy. I am so sad and depressed. And I would say, but you're happy the other 99% of the time. But I'm so miserable now. You get it, right? We want to be happy, content, and at peace 100% of the time. Is that even possible? In a worldly sense, let's admit, in a worldly sense, it is utterly impossible. With worldly efforts, it is absolutely impossible. Look at the dilemma we place ourselves in. We all seek 100% happiness, contentment, and we admit it's an impossibility. How ridiculous is our conventional thinking? This is conventional thinking. We want to be happy. Work harder so you can be more happy. How much? Look how hard you work today to be happy half the time. You work so hard, and maybe you're happy half the time. What would it take to get to 99%? Is that even possible? And if 99% isn't possible, 100% is absolutely impossible. This is an indictment of how ridiculous conventional human thinking is. Conventional human thinking is that you should work hard for the sake of being happy, but you want to be happy 100% of the time, which is absolutely impossible. How ridiculous it is that we are all committed to an impossible goal. Then where is the solution? There is a solution. The solution is hidden. And we're going to spend much more time on this when we get further into the text. Well, let's get a little, I think they call it sneak preview. So we're getting the sneak preview. And the sneak preview is this. We seek this perfect contentment and peace outside. Everywhere outside. At home, in the workplace, in the bar, in Atlantic City, anywhere. In a restaurant, in whatever activity you're engaged in, you're seeking happiness, contentment, peace, and trying to get that percentage up above 50% and towards 99%. You're trying hard to do that. But something we all intuitively know is that the actual source of that contentment lies where? You've known that for a long time. You know very well the actual source of contentment, happiness, joy, peace, love is within. You know it well. Then why in the world are we so focused on external pursuits for the sake of that happiness and contentment? More ridiculous conventional thinking. How ridiculous it is, we can see, we'll end our class with this famous story, which is then going to show that word Atmaha. Why does Shankara say you're virtually committing suicide? The story that's most often used to illustrate this ridiculous situation, the ridiculous situation is we spend our lives running around outside, searching for the happiness and contentment which is actually within. It's like the person looking all over for her glasses. Where did I leave my glasses? Where did I leave my... Yeah. We spend all of our time looking in the wrong place. The story that's used to illustrate this is the famous Dashma Purusha story. Ten people. In this version, 10 boys. 10 boys are on a pilgrimage to a temple. The oldest boy is in charge, and they go across fields and forests and along the route into this temple. They have to cross a stream. They have to cross several streams. Several of them, the streams are, they can just walk across. One stream is so deep, they have to swim across. One at a time, each of the 10 boys swims to the far side of the stream or river. On the other side, the oldest boy wants to make sure everyone got across safely. He asked the boys to line up, and he's going to count. He's taking roll call, as it were. So he counts the boys. He counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Now he's counting to make sure all 10 got across. He counted 9 and stopped because there were 10 of us, he said. Where is the 10th? He counted again to see if he miscounted. But again, he counted again and again. Every time he counted 9, he concluded that one boy is missing. And then he proceeded to run around looking for the lost boy. He looked in the forest on this side of the river. He looked in the jungle on that side of the river. He looked upstream. He looked downstream. This boy ran around in a state of panic, thinking that one of his fellow boys had drowned in the river or was eaten up by an animal. This boy is running around in a panic looking for whom? Himself. Before we finish the story, is this boy enjoying himself? Pretty miserable, right? He's in a state of panic. He's really stressed out. He is running around like crazy, looking for what's already here now. That story describes the horrible futility of life. Spending a lifetime running around maybe not in a state of panic, but certainly with a considerable amount of stress and pressure, running around looking for contentment, looking for peace, looking for joy, failing to recognize you already have what you want to possess. You already are what you want to become. Failing to recognize yourself for the divinity, for the fullness, for the completeness that you already are, failing to recognize your true nature is atmaha, is suicide. Failing to recognize yourself, discarding yourself, swam vinihanti, vinihati. You kill yourself metaphorically by turning away from the beautiful truth, which is your true nature as Satchidananda. That's why Sri Shankaracharya uses such harsh language. Such a person is called a mudhadhi, is called a thick-headed person. Such a person is called atmaha, one who commits suicide by failing to recognize himself or herself as a source of the happiness and contentment that one foolishly seeks looking outside. So, such a person, swam vinihanti, such people, they destroy themselves, asadgrahat, grasping after the false. Looking around in the jungle, in the forest, upstream, downstream, all of that futile effort. This is what Sri Shankaracharya laments in this verse. Okay, this is a good place to stop. We will resume our text, our study in the next class. Some important announcements for your next class. Starting next week at 7:30, we'll begin with a brief meditation. From 7:30 to 7:45 for 15 minutes, we'll spend the beginning portion of each class we'll spend in meditation, which means it'll be important for you to come on time. These doors will close, and you can't come in during the meditation, right? So please be here on time. We'll give you a minute or two grace period, but then the doors will close, and then we'll be engaged in meditation. So remember that starting next class, we'll start with meditation. Also remember, before you come to the next class, you're going to get one of the translations. and you're going to read it before coming to class to prepare for each class. That'll be very important. And you're going to bring that translation to each class so that you, because, you know, if you're not following the Sanskrit, you may like to refer to that translation now and then. So please have that translation with you. Also, we're going to need two more volunteers to assist with getting the lecture hall ready for our class and also for closing up the lecture hall after class. Well, it means turning on the lights, turning on the heat, putting the lamps on the altar, just the simple things, but we're going to need two more volunteers for that. Would anyone like to volunteer to help? We're going to need two more. One. Good. Okay. Good. Would those of you who have raised your hands, would you meet after class? Usha, would you stand, please, so that they can see? Would you meet with Usha and Shakuntala? Would you stand? Yeah, you can meet with Usha and Shakuntala after class, and they'll get you on board for that. Good. So, again, it's a delight to see so many of you for this class. I think we're off on a very good start. I'm looking forward to our further classes. We'll see you next Tuesday. We'll conclude each class with our prayers at the altar.